Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of You Make Me Sick. Today, I am joined by an extremely special guest, Dr. Davidson Hamer. He's here today to talk about arboviruses. We're going to focus primarily on the dengue virus. For those of you who aren't familiar, Dr. Hamer is a professor of global health and medicine at Boston University School of Public Health and Cobanian and Avicennian School of Medicine. He's also an adjunct professor of nutrition at Tufts University Fridman School of Nutrition and Policy. He's a specialist in infectious diseases with a particular interest in specializing in tropical infectious diseases. He has extensive field experience in neonatal and child survival research, including studies of micronutrient interventions, maternal and neonatal health, malaria, pneumonia, and diarrheal diseases. He's been doing this for over 20 years now. He's supervised and provided technical support to numerous studies in developing countries. He is also a fellow at the American College of Physicians, Infectious Disease Society of America, the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene, and the International Society of Travel Medicine. And he is also one of the leads for the GeoSentinel project. Did I get that correct?
It's the GeoSentinel Surveillance Network. GeoSentinel
Surveillance Network, thank you. I thought that I had it in my notes somewhere, but for whatever reason, I'm not finding it. who actually work hand-in-hand with other researchers and physicians throughout the world. And you guys collect data and essentially try to get ahead of disease. Is that a correct explanation of how that works?
So GeoSentinel is a surveillance network and research network now that looks at returning travelers, immigrants, and refugees, and tries to assess what infections they picked up during their travels, where they acquired them, and then epidemiologic and clinical characteristics. So we have about 70 sites in 30 countries that systematically provide data for our surveillance efforts.
It's a very broad scope. He's also been published hundreds of times in various medical journals, all the way from the Journal of Global Health, the International Journal of Infectious Disease, American Journal of Medicine, and many, many, many more. So thank you very much for joining us today. Today, I just kind of want to talk about arboviruses. So over the past few months and really the past few years, we've seen large numbers of increases in viral illnesses related to mosquitoes here in the United States and worldwide. And I was just wondering to start if you can explain what an arbovirus is.
Sure. An arbovirus is really a broad term for arthropod-borne viruses. Arthropods are insects, so it's really any kind of virus that's carried by an insect. Usually refers to mosquito-borne diseases, but technically it can be, midges, ticks, and so forth.
So I was wondering, can you explain how exactly they're spread? So there's different types of mosquitoes that can carry the viruses. And if you could explain kind of if there's a difference geographically throughout the world and the differences between these mosquitoes.
Yes. I mean, there's some major differences. Many diseases in the broad sort of category of arboviruses are spread by Aedes family mosquitoes. So Aedes aegypti and sometimes Aedes albopictus. For example, dengue, chikungunya, Zika, and yellow fever are all carried by those kinds of mosquitoes. In contrast, something like West Nile virus is carried by Culex mosquitoes, and then Eastern equine encephalitis by Culicetta mosquitoes, and sometimes other species. So there's sort of different mosquito sort of populations that are specific for viruses, but also there's different ecologies in terms of where they occur.
So with regard to the mosquitoes, I know that there was a study that came out in 2019 from PLOS Biology that had shown evidence that a single mosquito can actually carry two different viruses at the same time, possibly infecting somebody with two different viruses at once. Do you think that right now, that's a concern right now with the spread of all the arboviruses that we're seeing between, we have dengue and, like you said, chikungunya? Is that something that's been a concern?
Yes. I mean, I think it's probably not too common to have mosquitoes carry multiple viruses. And it's definitely possible for an individual human to become infected with more than one virus concurrently. In fact, there's a little study, a prospective study of children in Nicaragua looking at dengue that happened to follow them longitudinally over time during the chikungunya outbreak there that was followed by the Zika outbreak. And all three were circulating at one point, and they showed that some of the children were infected with two of the three and sometimes all three at the same time. So it's definitely possible for people to become, you know, concurrently infected. And whether that's by one mosquito or the bite of multiple mosquitoes, that's a little harder to tell.
So there's often anxiety and fear when hearing about viral outbreaks, just due to the possible human-to-human spread. With regard to our arboviruses, this really isn't a concern, though, right? Because they're considered dead-end hosts. Is that something? Is that a correct assumption?
Well, it depends. I mean, I think it depends on the virus. For most members of the arbovirus sort of broad category, they are not easily transmitted person to person. They usually need to go back to the mosquito or through another non-human host to be amplified. Dengue is an exception. Dengue can be amplified by humans, but you know, dengue person-to-person transmission is not, I don't, you know, if it occurs, it's extremely rare. Zika is a major exception, though, because Zika could be and was transmitted sexually.
And to date, so I guess the follow-up to that is because there have been large numbers of dengue virus this year and last year, and it's something that's year over year growing, is it something the public should be concerned about? If, you know, they come in contact with somebody who has dengue, they shouldn't have to worry too much about any kind of exposure or
contracting dengue,
right?
No, not at all. Not with dengue. I mean, but they should, you know, if that person is actively infected and they have the right mosquitoes in their neighborhood, in their area, then, you know, the risk for transmission via mosquitoes is can be substantial.
So let's talk about dengue too. So a few months ago, you actually shared with me a graph, and it represented just a steep rise in dengue, and that was just for the first few months of the year. Since then, it's just exploded. So I think that last I checked, there were 11.4 million cases worldwide, if I was correct. Last year, the total number of cases was around, was it 6 or 6.5 million? Mm-hmm. So we've almost doubled that already, and there's still, what, three months left in this year too. What do you feel is contributing to this increased spread of dengue, and how do you feel that these numbers will actually continue to climb?
I think this is going to be a banner year for dengue, absolutely. 11 million plus, and honestly, through GeoSentinel, we're seeing a lot of cases coming in from South Asia, so India and Bangladesh right now, but also Southeast Asia, Thailand, Indonesia, other countries in that area. And so I think the total number is going to be probably 13 to 14 million.
Wow.
So much more, maybe double of what we've had in any one year. Why this is occurring is a challenging question. I think it may relate to both a combination of climate change, sort of warming of the climate, but also the sort of climate variability that occurs every several years when we go from La Nina to El Nino and back. With sea surface temperature changes in the Pacific Ocean, but those can affect weather patterns worldwide. And like if we just focus on Massachusetts for a minute, last summer we had a very fairly wet summer. This summer we had one of the hottest months in July we've ever had, and that combination of a wet summer followed by a really warm summer allows mosquito populations to explode. And so I think that the sort of combination of factors like that, you know, in different parts of the world has been responsible for the massive increase in dengue.
So something that the GeoSentinel project actually works on is following where these diseases start to emerge and they come from. And we were talking earlier, and you were talking about the different types of how they're actually kind of labeled either, you know, between something that's an imported case or something that's locally transmitted. Are you able to explain just a little bit the difference between those, something that would be considered locally transmitted?
Sure. Dengue is endemic in many, many countries worldwide, especially in areas where Aedes aegypti, the primary vector, is common. And those are usually tropical areas because Aedes aegypti cannot survive frost. It can't survive through the winter. So basically in the U.S., there's been occasional cases in Florida, in Texas, of local transmission, but most of it is south of the border. So Mexico, the Caribbean, South America, but then much of South Asia, Southeast Asia. So people that travel those areas may pick up dengue, come back with it, and that would be characterized as a travel-associated case. But if there are the right vectors, the right mosquitoes in the place they live at, if they come back and they're viremic, they have, you know, a lot of dengue virus in their blood, then a local mosquito bites them, goes on and feeds to somebody else. on someone else, and then it can lead to local transmission. And in the U.S. in the last decade, there every year or two there have been a few cases in Florida, with some cases, some years, many more cases. And often those are people traveling back and forth to the Caribbean and coming back, but then that leads to some local transmission. Last year, I think there were several other places. I think they had some in Southern California and Texas and maybe Arizona as well. In Europe, they've been having increasing numbers of what they call autochthonous transmission, which is basically a complicated way of saying local transmission. and it is, so there have been more and more dengue outbreaks. In fact, we were worried that there could be dengue during the Paris Olympics, because you've got tens of thousands of people coming in from all over the world. A few of them could have dengue, and they have the right kind of mosquitoes. They have Aedes albopictus in the greater Paris region. There weren't any cases I'm aware of, although the French were doing more enhanced surveillance. But if you go back a summer, there were three cases of dengue local transmission outside of Paris, because they do have pockets of the right kind of mosquito. So I think these events are going to become increasingly more common in the future.
And you were talking earlier about kind of the like seasonality and how you'll have, depending on La Nina, El Nino, and climates, will mosquitoes eventually, do you think over time, become more endemic to those areas where they weren't before geographically, just due to the weather changes? Is that something?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's already starting to happen. It's complicated in one way. I mean, Aedes aegypti, as I mentioned, is really sort of temperature sensitive. But if the areas of the, say, south of the United States, if they don't have cold winters, if they have sort of winters that are milder, there's a chance that they can survive the whole winter, and so that they may move further north. And then in places where Aedes albopictus exists, Aedes albopictus can overwinter. It can basically sort of go into hibernation, and then when things warm up again in the spring, it come back out. But if we have a mild winter and spring temperatures start to rise sooner, basically a shorter winter, then we're going to have earlier mosquito populations available for potential transmission.
With regard to dengue, it can often cause infections that are either mildly symptomatic or asymptomatic, and those individuals sometimes probably don't get tested, or they may live in an area that they don't have the ability to actually be tested for dengue. Do you think that this could kind of actually increase the number of dengue cases that are occurring right now? Do you think that's a larger number than what we're seeing? Like I said, I think it's 11.5 million so far worldwide. Do you think it could be much more than that just because we're not properly diagnosed?
Yeah, I mean, with dengue, we estimate that I think it's like 75% of episodes are asymptomatic. So the confirmed cases that have been described, which are 11 million plus, as you stated earlier, probably if you multiply that by four, that's about the number of actual dengue cases.
Yeah, it's a gross underestimate of what it actually
exactly
should be. Wow. Can you explain kind of the symptoms of dengue fever?
Sure. I mean, fever. Sometimes a mild, very light rash, almost like a sunburn, headache, muscle pain, joint pain, and sometimes almost like a bone pain, where you feel just like incredible pain in your joints and your bones, and then occasionally eye pain. The old nickname for dengue is break bone fever because of the severe pain that can come with it. People also may have some degree of sort of clouded sensorium where they're not able to really think that clearly and be very fatigued. The complications of dengue can occur from bleeding, but maybe we can talk more about sort of more severe disease.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. So, because from what I was reading, there are four different types of the dengue virus. So they're named D, N, G, 1 through 4, respectively. And I was just wondering, with the body's immune system, if you come in contact with one of these viruses, say you come in contact with dengue 1, are those antibodies protective against the other forms of dengue?
The answer is briefly yes, but not for long term. So there are four serogroups, serogroups 1 through 4, probably even more complicated than that because there are genotypes within the serogroups, and that you may be able to become reinfected. Historically, we have thought that if you're infected by serotype or serogroup 1, that you ended up with lifelong protection against that. But there are at least one study, again from this cohort in Nicaragua, where they showed that children can become reinfected with that same serotype. It may be a difference in that it's a different genotype, but that's something we need to tease out through molecular sequencing. But basically, shortly after an acute episode, you have cross-reacting antibodies that give good protection against the other serogroups, but then those wane with time, and they become sort of not as tight-fitting to the virus. And that's when things become more dangerous, because if you're exposed to, say you've had serogroup 1 and it's like, you know, 6 months out, 8 months out, and you're exposed to serogroup 3, those cross-reacting antibodies won't protect you, but actually they bind the virus and help more of the virus to get into your white blood cells and cause a more severe infection. So this is a phenomenon called antibody-dependent immune enhancement. And that means that with your second episode, you might end up with a more severe infection and have complications that arise with severe dengue.
Yeah, with regard to that, so now when treated properly, dengue usually doesn't have an extremely high mortality rate. Around 1% is what I was reading. But with cases of severe dengue, you can have mortality rates as high as 10 to 20%. Mm-hmm. And is that when you're talking about the hemorrhagic?
So severe dengue is sort of, there's some specific definitions for it, but basically it's dengue with bleeding and dengue with shock, where you end up with basically movement of fluid out of your vessels into sort of the pleural cavity, the perineal cavity, the extravascular space with a lot of edema.
And so distributive type.
Yeah, sort of a fluid distribution issue, and it's really tricky to manage because if you give more fluids, you can end up becoming more edematous. So it's like, you know, it's really tricky to manage these patients. And then the bleeding is another issue too, because they can have pretty profound, they can have a DIC-like picture, but they also can have fairly profound thrombocytopenia with, you know, very low platelet count. And I remember touring a hospital in Thailand, and they had patients where they had basically a barrier around them saying no phlebotomy, no contact, because their platelet count was like 10,000. And you know, anything is going to lead to either oozing or bleeding or you know, bruises.
So are there demographics that are more prone to severe illness?
I mean, I think the people living in endemic areas that have had the disease before seem to be at greater risk. Generally, children also, and probably like any disease, elderly individuals.
Yeah. Do you see higher mortality rates in the very young and the very old?
Higher,
as with almost all illnesses.
Yeah. I mean, as you said, you know, dengue mortality rate is not that high. I mean, severe dengue, I think in the most recent thing I saw was as little as 0.1%. You know, I usually think about it, you know, more as, you know, 1 or 2%. And then only a subset of those go on to die. But again, if you have severe dengue, you know, your risk of mortality definitely increases.
So the mortality rate, as we were saying, it's pretty low. But at the same time, if you have a lot of people who are even mildly sick, it can put a significant burden on healthcare systems, especially if you live in an area that doesn't have adequate resources to actually help you. Do you think this will become more problematic as the numbers of dengue rise and becomes more of a problem over the next, I don't know, 5 to 10 years in those areas? Or do you think the healthcare systems in these underdeveloped countries are going to be more burdened than they are right now?
I mean, it's already happened. I mean, I think with the outbreak in Brazil this year, I mean, we mentioned, you know, 11 million cases. I think the estimate is that 6 million of those or more were in Brazil alone. And so there, their healthcare facilities were saturated with patients, and it just, it means patients with other problems are you know, sort of deprioritized in a way, and then it's just a lot of extra work for clinicians. So I think that, yeah, this could really stress hospital and healthcare systems.
A lot of times here in the United States, we really don't start to show a lot of concern for certain diseases or illnesses, and they'll become a domestic problem here. Dengue has been a disease that, you know, until recently has been more prevalent in areas south of the United States, in tropical areas. Like you said, you see it once in a while, Florida, Texas. As the numbers of dengue increase, do you think that there'll be more priority within the United States, at least, to put more money into prevention and actually detection of dengue?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that you know, at the state level, there's surveillance systems in place, you know, especially in Florida and Texas, where they have sort of local transmission nearly every year now, up to varying degrees. But I think because of the movement of Aedes albopictus all the way up to New England, even into Ontario and Quebec, The potential, you know, there's potential for introduction, and you know, with warming temperatures, that will continue. And I think state systems need to be ready with, you know, stronger surveillance systems. And you know, we haven't talked about vaccines. I mean, there are, you know, two vaccines for dengue prevention. Both of them have issues. There's a third one in process, and you know, I think that we're going to need really good vaccines for dengue control, as well as, you know, surveillance and control of mosquito populations.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the vaccines, actually. So you mentioned there are two of them right now that are, quote-unquote, pre-qualified by the WHO, the TAK-003 and CYD-TDVD, the vaccines. The WHO estimates that there are 100 to 400 million cases of dengue worldwide each year, with 3.8 billion people living in dengue-endemic countries. So do you think this is going to encourage more pharmaceutical companies to create vaccines for dengue? Is this something that, I know you have a little experience working with the vaccine development, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you think this is something that's going to prompt pharmaceutical companies? And if you go in a little more in depth on with the vaccines, you know, how effective they are, and if there's areas where, like you said, they have some kind of drawbacks to them.
Yeah, major challenges. So, the short answer to your question is yes. I think that there's a lot of interest in dengue vaccine development, but it's tricky because there are the four different serotypes, and you need to have a vaccine that protects against all four. The problem with the Sanofi vaccine, which is the CDY something or other,
TDV,
TDV, was they seem to have a problem with antibody dependent enhancement in populations so that had not had dengue before. So the children that had dengue before had protection that lasted several years, but those that had not had it initially had very good protection against, you know, virologically confirmed dengue, but it waned, and then they started having more episodes, more severe disease, hospitalization, and deaths. And so that vaccine also has limitations. I think it's based on a dengue 1 backbone, if I remember right. And doesn't work so well for 3 and 4. But in any case, the manufacturer, that was approved for use in the United States, but only in Puerto Rico, Guam, and any area, territories that have dengue, and only for children in a certain age, and only if they had an antibody test that shows they had dengue before.
Wow, yeah.
So very limited. So not available for travelers. But what's happened is Sanofi's going to stop producing that vaccine.
Really?
Because they just feel like it's just not good enough.
Yeah.
So TAK-03 is actually the trade name is Q-Denga, is made by Takeda, and that one is based on a dengue 2 backbone, has very good protective efficacy against dengue 1 and 2, it mixed for 3, and then they didn't have any dengue 4 in the major phase 3 trial that led to approval. So they don't really know how well it protects. With dengue 3, I say mixed because they actually were very organized in their trial. They stratified based on serostatus, so seronegative versus seropositive. And those who are seropositive to begin with had better protection against dengue 3, whereas those that were seronegative had almost no protection against dengue 3. And
wow.
So that went through review by the FDA and the ACIP in the United States. And they were so hard on Takeda and asked for more data that Takeda withdrew their application. So that vaccine is not available in the United States, and they're working, I believe, on collecting more data. It was approved in a number of countries in Europe. I mean, there's a equivalent of the FDA in Europe is the European Medicines Agency, and they approved it, and then several countries have approved it, although with different eligibility criteria. But that said, a lot of my colleagues in Europe are using it for their travelers. There's a third vaccine that's being produced by Merck and Butantan, a company in Brazil. And that just came out with their phase 3 trial results, and it was pretty good, like, you know, 80-90% protective efficacy, but mostly against serotypes 1 and 2, and they didn't have much serotype 3 or 4. So we're struggling to find the optimal vaccine for dengue.
Do you think it would be problematic if you have, say, you get one of these vaccines and you're well protected against serotype 1 and 2, and you come in contact with serotype 4, could that cause that kind of reaction we were talking about before that would spur that severe dengue?
Yeah, that, you know, sort of the antibody-dependent enhancement. I think that Takeda's trial, they looked at this very carefully and didn't see that. You know, they followed people out to 4 or 5 years and haven't seen it yet. So, but on the other hand, they haven't had exposure to a lot of other serogroups. So, you know, I think time will tell, but that's something that, that needs to be built into the sort of, you know, medium and long-term analysis of these dengue vaccine trials.
So the WHO recently released a list of possible pandemic-causing pathogens. I know pandemic is kind of a word that's, you know, sometimes overused or misappropriately used, and this was a large list that had a lot of different pathogens on it. Chikungunya was also on there. Though human-to-human spread isn't truly, or not truly, so it isn't really a concern with dengue, could you ever see a situation where dengue could cause a pandemic, I don't know, any kind of type of pandemic or a pandemic type?
I mean, I think it could potentially, I mean, because we have widespread distribution of, geographic distribution of competent vectors, you know, I think it's unlikely in a high-income country like the United States or France or Italy because of surveillance and then use of mosquito control measures. But definitely in low- and middle-income countries, there could be explosive outbreaks of dengue. And there have been, like in Brazil in the last year.
Do you think sometimes the WHO will place certain pathogens on these lists just to try to get more funding or draw more attention to these potentially, you know, more widespread illnesses?
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think it helps? Is that helpful?
It does, because it means, you know, they can mobilize more resources for it. I mean, they just did that with Mpox in Africa, and that's led to sort of a really acceleration of trying to get vaccine and treatments.
Which is good, too, because this new clade is just, it seems...
Right. Clade 1B, which is more... severe and has spread beyond sort of the classic countries like the Democratic Republic of the Congo. I mean, there's a bunch of different countries in Africa that have some cases now. It's pretty worrisome. And it may have become, we don't know this, but it may have become even more transmissible. I mean, just sort of through close contact.
Really?
Yeah.
And so it's similar. It's the same class. Orthopox. Is it orthomyxovirus?
Yeah.
It's a similar class to what smallpox was, correct?
Exactly. Yeah.
So I think that was
pox,
one.
It's a pox virus.
Yeah, one of the concerns I think initially with Mpox was that because it is from that family, just the smallpox outbreaks, as we know from history, have been absolutely devastating. Yeah. But so.
Yeah, I mean, this is not as severe as smallpox. Smallpox can have a case fatality rate of like 30%. But it is. I mean, fortunately, clade 1 used to, like, in low-income settings, was causing a case fatality rate as high as 10%. Current outbreak, it's a little bit lower than that, but probably because we're getting a little bit better at managing patients and trying to carry them through it. But that said, it's a severe disease. And part of the reason it's expanding is because older people had protection because they had smallpox vaccine. And they cross-protected against Mpox. But we're digressing.
Yeah, I know. Sorry, a little tangent there. So I guess lastly with dengue, you know, you had talked about expectations over the next few years, over the next 50 years. So if you look at climate trends, I think the, you know, global climate trend, it's gone up 1 or 2 degrees over the last 50 years. They're expecting it probably to rise even more. Even within the next 25 years, I think a lot of times they set the next benchmark at 2050, which isn't that far off, you know, almost 25 years from now. Do you expect to see dengue kind of reach areas, you had mentioned already that we're seeing in areas as far as Canada, do you expect it to become just more prevalent worldwide in geographic areas that didn't have dengue prior to the last 20 years?
Dengue and several other arboviruses, including chikungunya, possibly Zika, maybe Mayaro, maybe Oropouche virus, all are going to have much more widespread distribution over the next 25 years.
So kind of moving on from dengue, I was wondering if you could field a couple of questions on West Nile and then Triple E, Eastern Equine Encephalitis. Here in Massachusetts, we're seeing increased numbers of both this year. Year to year, it can vary. I don't think last year there were any Triple E cases, but the year prior to that, I think there were 5. This year, we've already seen, I think there was another confirmed case yesterday, bringing the total up to
3
right now in Massachusetts, right? With regard to West Nile, I was wondering if you could just explain a little bit as far as, one, the mosquitoes that carry it. I think you were talking about different, the mosquitoes that kind of carry other viruses or other arboviruses. And then do you continue to see an increase in West Nile cases kind of this year and beyond, just because of the different factors similar to dengue with climate change and how it's affecting just the mosquitoes themselves?
Yes. I mean, West Nile virus transmission is complicated. I mean, normally it cycles between certain species of birds and mosquitoes. And so anything that can lead to a bigger mosquito population, it's Culex mosquitoes in particular, and some of them are found in sort of urban, peri-urban areas, but some of them are very rural, and so it can be widespread. It moves around the country through migrating birds. Humans are dead-end hosts, so we can become very sick from it, although reality is with West Nile, many people are asymptomatic. A small proportion, we estimate 5% of infections lead to West Nile fever, and only 1% end up with meningoencephalitis. But that said, it sort of comes and goes every year, and it probably is influenced by climate factors, but also bird migration patterns.
And so in general, people are usually don't get too sick from it. I know there's two designations of either. There's a non-neuroinvasive and then neuroinvasive cases. And I think you had touched on that with the neuroinvasive cases are usually the ones that are far more severe.
Yeah. So the neuroinvasive cases can be broken down into meningitis or encephalitis, or they can have a combination of the two. Meningitis is, you know, moderately severe, but most people do well with that. Encephalitis can be quite severe, can lead to death. It's more common in elderly people, you know, especially people over the age of 70, but to some extent over 60, perhaps with underlying medical conditions or immunocompromising disorders as well. The interesting thing, too, is that it affects part of the spinal cord and can lead to focal paralysis. So that may be a complication. In fact, one of the patients I had several years ago at Tufts Medical Center that had it during the first couple years of outbreaks in Massachusetts, he was a golfer in the Plymouth area, and he'd had a lot of mosquito exposure, you know, especially at dusk. And he ended up with focal paralysis of his left leg as a result of West Nile.
So even if it doesn't kill you, there's still a lot of
long-term neurologic complications, definitely.
With Triple E, so with Eastern Equine Encephalitis, if you could just touch on that a little bit and kind of explain, as far as Triple E, why there's a little more concern when it comes to people who actually contract Triple E.
So Triple E is complicated in terms of its ecology. It exists, again, in bird populations, usually more in swampy areas, and then cycles between birds and a kind of mosquito called Culicetta. We think that there may be what's called a bridge vector, which is other kinds of mosquitoes that feed on birds, become infected, and then can infect humans. We don't know very well, like, what proportion of infections are asymptomatic or may have a mild, you know, non-localizing febrile illness. But if people get encephalitis, they have about a 30% chance of dying.
Yeah.
And of those who survive, a good proportion will have permanent neurologic complications. So it's bad.
And with Triple E, we've seen, like I said, it kind of varies year to year. Here in Massachusetts, we've had 3 cases. I know that as far as north, Wisconsin had a case this year. And I was trying to look back with Wisconsin because it doesn't seem like a place where you'd see.
So Wisconsin's sort of out. I mean, most of it is in the Gulf Coast, up the Atlantic Coast, and New England, and then a little bit in the center of the country. Wisconsin is an outlier. And I read somewhere that they think that patient might have traveled to the Northeast.
Okay, that might
be. And so it may not be local transmission.
So I look back, and over the last 60 years, I think there's only been 8 cases total in Wisconsin, but I think 5 of those have happened since 2020.
Right. But it could be changing. It could be local transmission.
So,
and yeah, I mean, this year there's been, you know, 1 case in New Hampshire, maybe 2. Because I heard about another, I'm not sure this has been reported, and then, unless it's the same patient, and then 1 Vermont. 3 now in Massachusetts, 1 in New Jersey. Those are the ones I know about. But it's and that's, you know, like really bad years. You know, there can be 10 to 15 cases in New England. So we're not quite there, but
it's pretty
still,
rare.
It's rare. Yeah,
but it's still
rare.
Pretty severe.
But it can be very severe, and then, you know, so there have been a few deaths this year.
And here in Massachusetts, I don't know if they've been lifted or not, but I know that they did have curfews in certain areas for public areas and any kind of outdoor events that were happening after dusk, just as a, you know, public safety measure for public health. which I think is probably pretty
wise. Yeah, I mean, Massachusetts, there's two hotspots where they've identified infected pools of mosquitoes. One of them is in the greater Plymouth area, and then the other is, you know, near Worcester, a little south of Worcester. And those areas are telling people to be really cautious and maybe reschedule events that would have happened, you know, in the early evening.
Do you know how often they actually test the mosquito pool to see if that's something that's done weekly or every other day?
I don't know the frequency of testing, no.
And with Tripoli, there's no vaccine. I mean, this is something that's so rare. I doubt there's not a real rush to create a vaccine for it. I know that there was, when I was reading, there was one that was created for horses back in the 80s, and then there's one developed by the military in the 80s that never came to fruition. But there is a vaccine for horses right now, which I guess is good.
Right, and it's interesting because some of the earlier descriptions of Eastern equine encephalitis, you know, we're horses, and, you know, hence the name equine.
Yeah,
and it can be pretty devastating to horses, too.
And as far as prevention, for anybody who is just wanting to go take their dog for a walk, you know, at 6 o'clock at night, and they live in these areas, what would you tell them?
I would say, if you need to be out, wear long sleeve clothing that protects as much surface area in your body as possible, and then use an effective insect repellent like a DEET containing insect repellent, Picaridin, or some of the others that the CDC recommends.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Hamer, thank you so much for coming by. I know you're extremely busy, so I do appreciate you taking the time just to come and stop by and be on the podcast again. So thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it.
Good.
All right, everybody. Thank you very much for listening. As always, any emails for questions, comments, requests, you can email me at makemesickpod@gmail.com. Thank you again, everybody, for listening. And remember to please wash your hands.